policy director of DRN. What we're going to try and do is take some of the discussion of this morning and make it much more concrete. And what we're going to do is take three examples in Pennsylvania where a combined effort of both political and all the other types of strategies as well as legal advocacy were successful in moving the ball forward. And I really just say moving the ball forward because this is a very long, long process and it's often just moving the ball forward a little bit at a time. But so Linda's going to start by just making some general statements, and then as I said, we're going to take three very specific examples and try and focus on what worked in those instances that actually might be usable in another instance. Linda.
Hello, everyone. I hear you've been talking about me this morning. What you see up on the board is there's a pitchfork up there, and I know pitchforks don't have five prongs, but we needed to add one in order to cover everything. I learned a lot of my advocacy skills in a lot of different ways, but one of the ways has been through my work with the National Disability Rights Activist Group called ADAPT. And we use this pitchfork approach as a way of explaining to people how creating and achieving social change happens through a variety of ways. It's not any one thing that often gets things to really change. It's actually a combination of things. On the pitchfork, you see media, education. Many times when we're doing what we do with ADAPT or even with the issues that we're going to be talking about, you'll hear us talk about how we use the media to get the information out to the rest of the world. Many times they don't even know that there are people out there working on it. They may be wanting to join you. They may be wanting to hear more about it so that if there's something they can do themselves to help, they would like to do that. But getting the message out and building the public support behind our issues is how and why we use the media to do that. And we'll talk more specifically about how we do that. The other way is through legal means. That's why you're here, to find out legal, how do you use legal advocacy to also push for that social change. And we're going to get more specific about that later on in one of the examples that we're going to be giving you. I'm going to go over to the far side, and the other, one of the pitchfork prongs says system administrative. One of the things that, as I said, ADAPT is an activist group, so a lot of those folks are the people that are willing to be out on the street and do the hardcore, lay before the bus kind of thing. But behind all of that, there's also administrative advocacy. They're very boring, sometimes laborsome, drive you a little bit batty, but going to meeting after meeting after meeting. And sometimes it just feels like you're not getting anywhere, but you actually do need to do those administrative kind of things. You need to build a foundation upon which the social change will be based. Because if you're not at those tables, they're going to be designing it. And then you're going to have an even upper, a longer haul in trying to get it in such a way that consumers can actually use the service and it does what it's intended to do. So while they're very boring, meetings are necessary. Building that foundation is very necessary when you're trying to achieve a social change. The other is political. It's very important to bring the legislature along in understanding what it is you're trying to achieve because they allocate the money. Sometimes when we're not successful at getting the administration to see our point of view or to change things, we go around them and we go to the legislature and we use them as a vehicle to make sure the administration listens up and involves consumers in what it is that you're trying to redesign. And the legislature is very powerful because, like, as I said, they control the dollars. So it's just another way to do more advocacy, more foundation building, if you will, to get an issue to actually be changed. So politicians are very important. And then again, all politics are local. You got to work at this stuff, not just in Harrisburg, but in your home where you live. Going to their local legislative offices is just as powerful as coming to Harrisburg because it points out to them that you are one of their constituents. Oftentimes I go into a local legislative office and I may say, I'm one of your constituents. I don't say whether I voted for them or not. I don't have to. All they need to know is that I'm one of the people in their area that they serve, and that's why they're there. The very last one in the middle is direct action, and we include that when we do ADAPT training because that is the essence of what ADAPT does. Direct action has a lot of different definitions depending on who you're talking to. Some folks feel that direct action includes things like rallies, marches through the street, press conferences, those kind of things. In ADAPT, direct action is, as I said before, it may mean laying across the driveway of the Health and Human Services building. It may mean blocking a bus, lying under the bus, blocking elevators, making things uncomfortable for people. And what we tell our folks when they're doing that is, it's very hard. It's almost, you know, sometimes you're putting your own life in risk. But we think about the people that are trapped in nursing homes and other kind of institutions, and they don't want to be there. And so we try to keep our troops fired up. We try to keep our troops fired up so that they're willing to do that direct action. Many times, as I said, I had started working in doing disability advocacy by going to meetings. And what happened was, after a year of going to meeting after meeting, talking about the same thing at each meeting, and nothing really happened or moving forward, a friend of mine, Cassie James, said, "Why don't you come to this ADAPT training?" And I learned how you can take direct action and you can actually push the issue and make it happen. The point of direct action is to get yourself at the table with a set of demands, and then you start negotiating and making the things that you've hopefully laid down as a foundation in those administrative meeting after meeting, getting those things to actually come to be. Because sometimes it can't be business as usual, because politicians and the administration alike sometimes just end up doing what they want to do. And unless someone pushes that envelope, unless someone gets in their face and says to them, "This is not right, it's not acceptable," and you do the direct action so you can get to that table and get them to start making some real changes. So we try to keep this pitchfork idea in mind when we're talking to folks, so that they understand that it's not any one thing, and it's not just direct action by ADAPT that's going to make it happen. So what if you take over a bus? If you don't have someone, and if you don't have people among you who can talk about what it is they need to do to make it change, then it's really just kind of having a meeting and you're all going to sit there and look at each other, and they're going to say what it is they're willing to do. So we work very hard at all of these things, and we use all of them sometimes to make social change. And that's why I asked Mark if we could share this with you. The other thing, we're going to talk more about coalition building. And one of the things, sometimes it can seem overwhelming on building a coalition. But what happens when you build a coalition is you get the people behind you. You get the people behind the message. And we try very, very hard to get consumer input on anything we do, because we at Disability Rights Network, we know that some things are wrong, but we don't know exactly what it is. So to us, it's very important that we get the people, the consumers, the people using the services or trying to, their friends and family members involved, because they know better than anybody what's wrong with the system. And so we try to involve them in any way we can. Now, there comes a time, though, that, like I said, meeting after meeting, sometimes you have to recognize that unless you have a force behind you, it really isn't going to get anything done. And when I say a force, I mean a force of people out there who are yelling the same message that you are yelling, that are saying it over and over again. And one of the things about building a coalition is, the very first thing, I guess, is the idea that you have to have a common issue, something that everybody can get behind and say, "Absolutely, I believe that, and we all believe that." And years ago, I was running a statewide coalition for people with disabilities, and it was very important that we get out. I used to go to meetings of people with mental retardation, and people with mental health, and people with physical disabilities, and then people with sensory disabilities, and I just traveled all around. And we kind of came to the conclusion that there is something that we all want to fight for. We want to fight for the right to be in the community, no matter what our disability is. And one of the things we tried to impress upon everybody as we went around the state was the fact that if we don't stand together, if we divide and separate our advocacy efforts, every man for himself kind of mentality, then we all are going to lose. When the Americans with Disabilities Act was finally passed, a lot of that that commonality was raised and brought to the surface by a man named Justin Dart, who worked for two prior presidencies. And Justin went around to every state talking to people about why we needed the Americans with Disabilities Act. And what he did was pointed out to everybody that no matter what your disability is, it's discrimination to not be allowed to get housing in a certain place. No matter if it's because you have a mental health disability, whether you have a mental retardation, or you have physical or sensory, it's discrimination, it's discrimination, it's discrimination, no matter what it is. So in coalition building, you have to decide, what is that common issue? What is that one thing that all of us want to fight for? And for me, I mean, lately, I've had the fear that the point of let's look at community first for people's long-term care needs, and that is not something that we have ever made a cry for, a yell, a scream, if you will, about the fact that people want to be in the community first, and that should be the first option. Not looking at putting them immediately into an institutional setting when they need long-term services. Believe me, think about how powerful that is when we all stand up and say, community first. And that is the way how we can change the way we do policies and practices. That issue that you come up with, it may be short term, you may achieve that goal and then that coalition is done. Sometimes that's the way it works, but that's okay, because that coalition accomplishes the goal, the issue that everybody had in mind. So it may die off. They may find that there's now another issue. But you have to just keep in mind that it's one common issue that really is going to bring people together. And if we do need the power of all of us to fight this. This isn't just about the discrimination of one population. We are all being discriminated against in a variety of ways, but it's because we have disabilities, period. The other thing that you need to do, though, is once you form the idea of a common issue and you try to build a coalition around that issue, everybody that agrees to work within that coalition has to agree on that goal. They have to agree that that's what we're fighting for. They have to have a commitment to that goal. Because so often when you get started and you start advocating for that one common issue, all kinds of people have all kinds of ideas about how you should get it done. But and what little things you should be taking care of along the way. But the point is, there has to be always one goal that everybody agrees upon and they're committed to that goal and nothing else. Because when times get rough, you can remind people, you can fire them back up by reminding them, we have not reached that place yet. We are still being discriminated against. We are still being put in institutions by the practices that the administration is using. So you have to have people committed to just that goal, and they're not gonna get waylaid by what we call white noise. All the other stuff that starts coming up and all the other things that people want you to take care of. Because your people only have so much energy, and they need to believe in that goal that you create when you create that coalition. The other thing you have to do is, in order to sell it, you gotta believe it. You gotta believe that your goal is possible. I know all of you have probably been in a meeting or been somewhere when you've been told, oh, that can't happen. It won't work. It will never happen. Well, you know what? That's just the kind of thing that makes me even madder and hotter. And it's the kind of thing that you have to say, oh, yes, it will. I mean, they said that the Americans with Disabilities Act would never pass. Well, here we are. Many years later, and it did pass, and it is a law. So when someone says that it can't happen, you look them square in the eye and you say, absolutely it can, and we will make it happen. And you have to believe that if you're going to sell it to your group, to your coalition. You have to also get people who are ready to be in this for the long haul. Sometimes it takes years to accomplish something like that. Believe me, if we do create a coalition around community first, it's going to take years. Because you change administrations, because there's a lot of things along the way that have to be looked at, and how are we going to change that? How are we going to preserve the principles we want? So they have to be ready to be in it for the long haul, and they have to stay committed to the goal that everyone agreed to in the beginning. You can't change that. And then the other thing is something that I'm pretty bad about, and that is you have to celebrate your victories. Getting to a goal often takes little baby steps. You get something changed in the waivers for people with physical disabilities. We're right now pressing the administration to allow people who also have mental health disabilities as well as physical disabilities to be served by the waivers that give them the assistance they need for daily living. Just because they also have a mental health disability is absolutely no reason why they shouldn't also be able to get help with their physical problems. One of the things that we all do is age. And in that process, sometimes physical things start happening. Oh yeah, no matter what you think, Steve. But we all age, and things happen to our bodies, and we do need assistance. Many times we need assistance later on in life. So we need to make sure that all of our waivers are also going to serve people who have these other disabilities. But my point about that is that once you get a little victory, you celebrate that. You let your people taste it. Let them taste that victory. That's what's going to make them come back. That's what's going to make them keep moving forward. And the reason I say I'm bad about that is because oftentimes I help to put out a fire and then move on to the next one without looking back, only because I see so many in the future yet that we still gotta fight. But it's very important to let your people taste and feel that victory, because things can be changed, and they have to feel it, they have to get a sense of that.
A question back here.
Oh, okay. A question?
No,
back here.
How do you strike the balance between letting the body, the people that has been working with you, taste the victory? Earlier in the morning, I forget, it was, you were talking about, you know, the process of going through and saying, yay, we got this, yay, we got this, and everyone, you know, we have to have this victory, we have to taste this victory. But in truth, it wasn't really much of a victory. I personally think of mental health parity, and you know, really when you look at mental health parity, what came through the stimulus bill is much less powerful than either of the bills that were in the House or the Senate. But everyone's celebrating, yay, we have mental health parity, so okay, we have this victory because this hit the spotlight. But when in practicality, it seems almost as if it's a dismissal. So how do you strike that balance in needing to have the victory of yay?
I think both the mental health parity and Olmstead are exactly analogous. And well, if you ask most people on the street say we now have mental health parity, right? And even in reality, and I didn't follow the stimulus, so I'm not, okay, I'm assuming you're 100% right. We'll build on it. We'll make them eat the words that were in the press. And that's what we've tried to do with Olmstead. Try to do the ADA too. I mean, Linda is absolutely right. Those victories are important. And some of them may be really small steps. Some of them may be a lot more smoke and mirrors than, you know, in this room we would admit, but outside we won't admit that, because there are major victories outside and we're moving on to the next battle. And that's a really important, I mean, Linda's right on the money in terms of building our forces, and our enemies hear this. And you know, I want every employer to think that there is 100% mental health parity.
I'll finish up now for my portion, but I also want to say to you, you celebrate that victory, that it's even in there, and as Steve said, they can hold their feet to the fire, because sometimes they'll say things that they, you know, they don't understand, that we can then use as ammunition to say, look, you said this, and this is what you're gonna do. But you celebrate, and then when you're done with that celebration, someone fires them back up for what? So what are we gonna do next? Where are we gonna go next? What are we gonna do this time?
And you've set another goal, and it's like baby steps, and you get there eventually, but you always remind your folks that as you celebrate this victory, we are still not done. And we still have more to do, so let's get out there and get going, and you make sure that they understand that there's a whole lot more yet we've got to do, but we've got to say that at least it's been mentioned, at least there is independent living money in the economic stimulus package. And even though we tried to get them to gear that towards getting people out of institutions, I think it's more geared to employment. So I'm very sad that, but I'm still going to take it as a victory because independent living is independent living. So we hold them to the fire and we celebrate, but then we make sure our troops understand that this is just one step and we have a lot more.
Any questions?
Any questions of Linda before we begin with some specific examples? I tried to pick three examples in Pennsylvania that really that cross all the disabilities of most of the people here. And the first one I want to talk about is the closure of Byberry, or Philadelphia State Hospital. Most of the time, it had been prior to the end of the 1980s, which is when the Byberry closure began, that I would never want to file a major lawsuit unless there was already in place the kind of coalition that Linda talked about. But Byberry was the exception to the rule. And what happened is, in the late 80s, the governor announced the closure of Byberry, or Philadelphia State Hospital. That brought the coalition together. But what happened is, shortly after it was announced, Steve and I filed a lawsuit because the governor, although it's interesting how history has repainted itself, the governor then said it was always his intention to move everybody into the community. When he made that announcement, it was not his intention to move people into the community. That became his intention because of the work of the coalition. So very early on in that process, we filed a lawsuit to stop the transfer of people to another institution, because what looked like to us is they were going to just move everybody from Byberry to Norristown. And we wanted to prevent that. And that then provided the groundwork for the beginning of the coalition, which was actually called the Coalition for the Responsible Closing of Byberry State Hospital. And I think the reason I wanted to use this as an example is it's a really, I think, excellent example of the inner working between litigation and a coalition. The coalition was formed. The coalition then made certain rules on how it was going to conduct itself. And I think that's really important that coalitions think about how they're going to proceed. For example, are you sitting in the coalition as an individual, or are you sitting in the coalition as a representative of the group organization for whom you work? It's a very important distinction. If I sit in a coalition, do I represent the Disability Rights Network, or do I represent Eileen Shane? And each person has to decide that, and they have to decide that collectively, because it makes a very big difference. Number two, once you sit in the coalition, do you commit not to take any action outside the coalition? So that are you going to make all things that your organization or that you think secondary to whatever the coalition reaches in consensus? And if you don't particularly agree with the coalition or think that they're going far enough, have you committed yourself that you will not go in any direction other than the coalition? Or are you only with the coalition to the extent that you agree with them, and then when you don't agree with them, you're free to speak and say something differently? In the Byberry situation, we made a decision that everybody sat there as a representative of an organization, that no one was allowed to substitute for anyone at the table. So the individuals who sat there were the individuals who sat there for 2 years. Whoever it was, and nobody changed seats. And there was a reason for that, because we all got to know each other really well. And we worked out many, many, many differences. And the idea was that we forced ourselves to work out those differences because we were going to sit there every other week and meet with each other and talk until we worked out every difference. By the end of 2 or 3 years, which is when the coalition ended, we were all thinking exactly the same. It really was a bizarre phenomenon. That particular coalition was staffed, meaning there was a paid staff person, actually worked for the Mental Health Association, who staffed that coalition, who brought the coalition together each week, who kept notes, who kept on everybody to follow through. If you can afford it, staffing a coalition is probably the single most important thing in terms of getting the work done. Many coalitions can't afford that luxury. The first thing we did after forming the coalition was we set our goals. And it was really interesting because very early on in this process, we sat down as a group and decided that our goals were everybody who lives in Byberry goes into the community, Everybody who would have used Byberry gets services, so that for every person in Byberry, we're going to make sure some other persons are served.
And 2-to-1, Stephen?
2-to-1. For every person who got served out of Byberry, someone else had to be served in the community. And number three, and I'll never know why we came to this, we decided that $50 million had to go to the city of Philadelphia to support the people coming out of Byberry and the what we used to call the diversion class. After this was all over, if you talk to somebody who worked for the Department of Welfare, they would say that Byberry was a terrible failure, because what happened was Byberry was costing the state about $37 billion in state and federal funds, and when the whole thing was over, it cost the state about $50 million, and therefore it was a terrible failure. Of course, that was not the case. And for 2 years, 2 or 3 years, I think, we met every other week. And we had some very, very, very rough experiences in the closure, and it would take much longer than we have for me to go through all this. But we touched every piece of that pitchfork. When something happened in the media, every single person in our coalition was available to talk to reporters. So the reporter made 10 phone calls. They talked to someone who was from the advocacy community, who then referred them to someone who was a psychiatrist, who then referred them to somebody who was from the Mental Health Association. And they went around and made 10 phone calls. And lo and behold, everybody said the same thing, because we were all singing from the same hymnal, as someone used to say. We stayed focused. We never let any issue come up in that coalition that didn't have to do with the closure of Byberry, the diversion class to Byberry, and the appropriation funding for the city. The lawsuit actually took a very, very, very second place to the coalition. I'd say 90% of the work was done in the coalition, and once in a while, we had to file a motion in the lawsuit to sort of push things forward. So for example, the state at one point threatened to just close Byberry and move everybody over to Norristown, and we went into court to get an injunction against that. But the lawsuit was really the second, very, very secondary to the work. The work was done in the coalition. They met with the administration, they met with legislative leadership, they met both at the city level, at the state level. They worked as individuals, they worked as a group, but that was where the work was done. And as I said, the lawsuit did provide some aid to the coalition, but the coalition is really what moved things forward. And in the end, I think it was a victory. Everyone, except for a very, very, very small number of people, did end up getting moved to the community. It was the first major state hospital in the country, in a major city to close. Philadelphia became one of the first major cities in the country to be without a state hospital. Certainly only one in Pennsylvania, but, and we accomplished what we had set forth to accomplish. Now, that's not to say there weren't problems, it's not to say it was perfect, and it's not to say I wouldn't have done many things differently if I had to do it over again. But it's a good example of a combination of litigation and coalition building, media, political. We were involved in talking to the governor's office, the mayor's office. There wasn't a piece of the world that we didn't touch as part of that closure process. So let me stop there for a minute and see if there's any questions about one example of how we came together to do social change with both legal advocacy and coalition building. Questions? Linda asked if I wanted to mention that that's how Estelle Richmond came to Pennsylvania. Estelle Richmond came to Pennsylvania because she was hired to do the closure. Her first job in Pennsylvania, when she was brought in from Ohio, was to work for the state inside Byberry to manage the closure. That was sort of an interesting history. Okay, if there's no questions about that, we want to take another example. Linda talked about this one, and that's the example of attending care in Pennsylvania, which takes us back to the early 80s.
Actually, I wasn't around when they first started talking about attendant care in Pennsylvania. I believe Eileen was, and probably Steve, but there was a group of people that just, I don't know, I thought it was in a hotel, in a bar room, or a restaurant, but they actually sat around and were trying to figure out what it is. How can we get people to stop having to go into nursing homes or personal care rooms, whatever. But they came up with the idea that we needed attendant care. You actually have more of the history of that.
It was in the first instance, and it really was a very small group. I don't know, it was only 5 people, and it was actually sitting around the kitchen table. They had identified attendant care as the single most important issue. At that time, there was no service delivery system for people with physical disabilities at all. There was nothing. and they decided that's where they wanted to start, and they drafted a piece of legislation. And that's what happened around this kitchen table. Fortuitously, and really almost by coincidence, the Department of Welfare the next year began a pilot in attendant care. Actually, it's just sort of interesting how things sometimes come together. It turns out that a legislator had a niece who was in a car accident who became quadriplegic as a result, and she was receiving attendant care in another state. And this legislator that came to the department and said, this is a great program, you really need to do it. The department happened to have some money left over at the end of that year. Things were different in those days. And they decided to start a pilot program. Well, the community of people who had written this legislation, which is then sort of growing a little bigger and bigger because it really was beginning to take hold because people did see that as a really key thing. I said, well, yeah, that's great that we're having a pilot, but we still want the legislation. And so a very strong force began to grow to support the passage of attended care legislation. And that, in fact, did pass. And
Stephen, can you help me here? What year was that?
I think it was 88, but I maybe
86, thank you. 86. Now, this is where the story gets interesting, and I'm going to turn it over to Linda. So now we have the pilots functioning, the Attended Care Act 150 passed, and Linda?
And then,
Let me just also, since most of us think about, most of us think about waivers right now, Medicaid waivers. Congress amended the Medicaid Act to permit waivers about 82, 83. During almost the first 10 years, almost 100% were MRDD waivers.
That's a very important point.
I'm sorry, yeah. What kind of waivers?
MRDD.
Thank you. The legislation has
There's a question back here.
And in the legislation was language that required the state to maximize federal funds, something that people put in and no one thought a lot about. There was a question back there?
I don't know if I'm on the same wavelength as you, but when I was court ordered to be hospitalized and institutionalized, they had asked me that I needed mental health care workers, which they came out to where I live at and provided services for me. So maybe that could be an option for those people that do not want to go into the hospital or nursing home, that they have people that are in your area that can come out to assist you and take you back and forth where you need to go to the doctors.
That's a very good point. Each system, and this is again when we come back with each system calls things differently. What you're describing in the mental health system is very similar to what Linda's talking about, attendant care in the system that serves people with physical disabilities, where the attendant helps with activities of daily living. And in the mental retardation or intellectual disability system, we call people habilitative workers. And again, that's very similar to attendants. So we have different terms to really talk about the same thing that you're talking about, which is that someone needs assistance in daily living for what to get through the day.
Okay, so now, We have the legislation and it's in place. And my entrance into disability rights was actually working at the with the State Attended Care Advisory Committee. And I can remember my first or second time being at the state meeting. I was a little intimidated, didn't know a lot about disability rights. Tried to make some suggestions that to me seemed to make a lot of sense, but I was point blank told I need to get to learn the law. I need to read Act 150. And so I did. I got to know it very well. And we took the meetings back from the state. We said that we want to have our own chairperson and vice chair and our own secretary, and we want minutes, and we want you to put the money out to make that happen so these meetings can be recorded, so we know, and notices get out, and to put a little money towards it. But I think the most crucial thing was that we took it back from the state. The state was running it. They were setting the agenda. They never gave us an opportunity to bring up the problems that we saw happening. And so we took those meetings back from them. And then we started setting about doing principles and things that we felt, no matter how the program would ever end up going forward, that certain principles had to be adhered to. One of them being the idea of a person having a consumer control program. And a program where, because many people with physical disabilities are well able to design their own system, to decide what it is they need help with, because many of us work, And have a time schedule that we need to adhere to. We said that it's very important that people be able to have a model that's going to let them direct their own care. And so we actually worked out with them different types of models within attendant care, where if you didn't want to go hire your own person, if you wanted an agency just to send someone out to you, you could do that. So we were working on those kind of things. And we were also meeting with legislators so that every year the program would get funded, so that the legislature understood why it was important to put the money to that. And then in turn, as I said, working with the administration through the advisory committee. But what we were also doing, I think, was building momentum behind the whole program. More and more people wanting it, needing it. And I believe that one of the things that they placed in the legislation helped us to expand the program and bring in Medicaid dollars. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to talk more about what happened with this attendant care program. At first, it was just state money, state funded dollars going into the program. And of course, they started building a waiting list. And every year, at the end of the year, they would have 800 or 900 people waiting for services. And when you have a physical disability and can't get out of bed, if you have to wait that long for services, many times what was happening was our people were still going into nursing homes or dying without the help in their homes. Or they were just trapped in their homes and couldn't go anywhere. Their family members were carrying them up and down steps. It was ridiculous. So as that amount of people waiting for services got bigger and bigger, and every year it seemed like they were not putting enough money into it, we started advocating to get more money into the program. And we started using some of those approaches in the pitchfork, getting the media to see what it means for a person with a physical disability to have services, to help them go to work. The fact that we employ people who become attendants, and oftentimes it can be people who may not have a college education or something because they don't need that. The person, I can direct someone and let them know how to help me. And so it made a lot of opportunity, not just for the person receiving the help, but for the attendants who were providing the assistance in our homes. Yes, do you have a question?
I can agree to that, but when I was institutionalized at Harrisburg State Hospital before they closed, I was on a committee here too, and how I got there is I called crisis. Crisis intervention didn't direct me to where I needed to be. The police came, mental health workers came, rape counselors came, all sorts of people came, my family came, and it was a freedom of choice. You didn't get court ordered until you agreed that you wanted to be committed to a hospital or some type of facility. So I can agree to some of the things that you're saying and that we were working on there too. But the state said that the people that were there were long-term care, too long. And they were just reviving, actually, because they were, the funding just came through after so many years. If they're like 30 years and the state didn't have the money. But there are still people working on the state hospital grounds that work with me each Friday, and they may open it. So I can agree to what you're saying, that is true.
Thank you. We actually see there can be a whole ladder, a career ladder for attendants, because serving someone who, say, has autism would be different than assisting someone like me who can self-direct. So we see that there's a need for a variety of levels for a person to be an attendant. But that's a whole probably another conference. So the other thing, one of the things we decided to do is we needed to do something very drastic to stop the waiting list so that people stopped going into nursing homes. And what we decided to do was we decided to pitch some tents downtown across from the Capitol at Soldiers Field. We set up, it was called Tent City. We stayed out there for 2 weeks, sleeping sometimes in the tents across from the Capitol. Sometimes we moved the tents up to the governor's house Outside of his house, we would circle the house with our tents or our lawn chairs, and we just slept out there. No matter what the weather was, we didn't go anywhere. And many times, the administration would send people out. I have this picture in my head of past Secretary Feather Houston standing beside one of our porta potties, which was very full, and it was very, very hot that day. And she was trying to convince us to take our tents down to work with them on getting something. But until we got a commitment, we were not prepared to leave. So we, after 2 weeks of doing this, we felt we needed to figure out some way to gracefully end it without, you know, not having anything. But what we knew was also going on were the lawyers were preparing to file a lawsuit on behalf of our people. So what we did was we timed that with them to say that the very last day that we had our tents out there, we encircled the intersection right outside the Department of Public Welfare building with our wheelchairs. And then we all jumped out of our wheelchairs and laid on the ground. Buses tried to get through. It was hectic and scary, but that is direct action. And what happened was we timed it so that it was happening exactly at the time that the Department of Welfare was being served with the lawsuit. And it was, to us, we wanted it to be like a double pow whammy thing. And you know what ended up happening? We have an interest list now, but we get money for attendant care every year. Even in these tight budget times, we have still gotten an increase in our attendant care program. In fact, as part of another group among the Disability Budget Coalition, I try to project what money we're going to need for the following year. And you never want to come under their amounts, so we always try to pad it a little bit. But you know what? They have often exceeded the amount that we've asked for. And I think it's just because they don't want us parking outside their house or across from the Capitol anymore. And through many administrations, we have been successful at keeping that waiting list at bay and people being served. So I wanted to explain that now.
And the lawsuit that was filed was actually a pretty straightforward one. Steve and I filed it, in which we claimed that the legislation said that there was a duty to maximize federal funds, and here you had a waiver where the federal government could pick up 50% of the cost of attending care, and yet you never bothered to file a waiver. And so we filed that lawsuit, and in fact, they settled the lawsuit by filing a waiver, which immediately eliminated the attending care waiting list because it doubled the amount of money in the system. So that was a really good example where the outcome was really driven not by the lawsuit, but by the activities of the group, really beyond the coalition. It was really more direct action. But the lawsuit sort of put the icing on that cake. Anne?
Bill.
No, but Anne has the...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anne.
I didn't see that other hand.
Wasn't there another lawsuit? Was it the Helen L. lawsuit?
Yeah, Helen L. is Helen L. was actually the case that is the precursor to the Olmstead case. It was the case in Pennsylvania that held it was a violation of the ADA to unnecessarily institutionalize persons with disabilities. It actually went further than Olmstead, and it was law in Pennsylvania for about 32 seconds until the Olmstead case was brought. It's interesting. Earlier, somebody was making this, I think it was Steve, making a point about impressions. The day the Helen L. case came down, we did not want the department to appeal that case to the Supreme Court. We had just won in the circuit. And so we actually got a call, I think from like the New York Times, because this case in the circuit is a significant thing. And we said to them, oh, it's a trivial case. It's really only about one person. And so because we didn't want to get any media, because we didn't want the department to appeal. And in fact, the department did not appeal, or not appeal, what's called file cert. But the next thing that happened was the filing of the Olmstead case about a year later.
With that case, wasn't that the situation where a woman was in a facility and wanted to live in the community, and the state said, we don't have any money, which is another thing the state says. We don't have any money to serve you in the community. And the
the overall decision was, well, if you have money to serve somebody in an institution, you have money to serve them in.
You're absolutely right. It's great to hear you remember that, because we sort of forget. Because Olmstead is really a narrower decision, because Olmstead lets the state say, well, we have money, but we need to spend it on something else, or we can't serve everybody who needs it. Helena really went much further. It said if a person was unnecessarily institutionalized, the state really had an affirmative obligation to provide a community alternative.
But so, Bill, we're going to come back to that principle. We're going to win that again.
Another lawsuit. Okay, we have another question.
Yes. Does Olmstead deal with Philadelphia and Camp Hill? Because I just had my daughter. I almost lost her because the state funding, I'm on county time, so I get funding through the county. And the stamp was not there. And they was very inconsiderate of others. They locked us up behind double doors. And I couldn't breathe and I couldn't get out. And so my daughter was delivered at Holy Spirit Hospital. She's 1 year old now. So through the county of Dauphin, I have to go to the Department of Welfare, which now my three children were children and youth. They're placing them for adoption with the county because of this funding.
The answer to your question is that Olmstead is the law of the land, because it is a case that was decided by the United States Supreme Court. So it is the law both in Philadelphia and in Camp Hill and everywhere in the country. Any other questions at this point? We wanted to use one more example, and in some ways, this last example is probably the most ideal example of what we're talking about. And that's the waiting list campaign for persons with mental retardation, or what we now prefer the term intellectual disabilities. And the reason is that this has really been run like a campaign. It's been going on for about 10 years now. It is a combination of, it's a group of mostly parents, and it also includes consumers, who actively meet with legislators every year. They target which legislators they're going to meet with. They have a specific ask in terms of how much money they need. They meet with the administration multiple times through the year at every level. They meet with the budget secretary. There's actually an interesting story around that 2 years ago. They never, by the way, take professionals in with them. When they meet with these folks, they just go parents and consumers. Nobody else goes in. 2 years ago, they went in and one of the consumers sort of was a young guy with autism, and he sort of broke down during the meeting. At the end of the meeting, the budget secretary, who is usually very difficult, basically turned and said, just give these parents whatever they want. Give them whatever they need.
Get them out of here.
No, but he meant it in a good way. Got a lot of money that year. We've made videos. We have a wonderful CD that we've made that has been sent to every legislature in the state, which just shows people on the waiting list how long they've been waiting, what their needs are, how their life has been affected by this. And it was actually much less expensive than you think. We've hosted legislative breakfasts. We have TV ads. We've had rallies. We have taken over the rotunda with photographs of people on the waiting list. We have constant media coverage. There's probably nobody in Pennsylvania, certainly in the legislature, who doesn't know what the waiting list is. And we've had a legislative study done in the last 3 years, or last 2 years, on the waiting list. And in the course of all this, we've done 3 lawsuits. The lawsuits have been, in the middle of all this, claiming that there is an entitlement to services. And in each case, the lawsuits help move the agenda of the campaign forward. And so this is a campaign that has now been going on for about 10 years, and it will end when there is no waiting list. And that will be the measure of the end of this campaign. But it's been very, there's an amazing number of people involved, and they are absolutely steadfast in their commitment to one issue. They only deal with the waiting list. And one of the things about this group is they're very, very focused on that issue. And you would not go to a coalition meeting with the waiting list campaign and bring up anything else, because nobody wants to talk about anything else. It's only the waiting list campaign. But I think you could almost write a playbook for what they have done. And they've been wildly successful in terms of moving towards the elimination, but have not yet eliminated the waiting list for services. They weren't as good as in the ADAPT situation. But that would be another example of, again, a combination of all the different types of advocacy, but including legal advocacy. And in that particular case, the lawsuits were very, very complicated, because you were sort of asking for one thing and you really wanted something else. and it required people who were very, very knowledgeable about what was going on to be plaintiffs in those lawsuits. And again, this was something that was managed by the coalition.
I just want to say something we said here about the fact that we don't have high-paid lobbyists to do our thing. I think the very best lobbyists we have are people like you sitting in this room, family members, friends, attendants even, those of us with disabilities. We live this stuff every single day, and that's what the legislature needs to hear about. They need to hear loud and clear from the people who are trying to live out in the community what the problems are. And no high-paid lobbyist can ever be as powerful as those of us with disabilities when we go in and talk about things. Because we talk about the day-to-day living out in the community and where the problems are. And that's the kind of stuff that they don't ever hear from high-paid lobbyists. So people with disabilities, their family and their friends, they are the very best ones to be going in there and telling legislators their stories.
What we're going to do now is take we take any questions, and after questions, we're going to take a very, very short break to give the CART reporter a break so she can stop moving her fingers for a few minutes, and then we're going to reconvene. We really can't take very long, though, because if we don't stay on track, we're not going to get through our agenda. Any questions at this point? Okay?
Right here, suppose. No question.
I have a question in reference to people that are deaf. If they ask for attendant care, and also in the nursing home, how are they adequately served, or can they be served?
Well, they can be served, they must be served, and they should be served. How is it? We try to teach people, we try to give them the skills so that they can advocate for themselves, particularly in situations where if you need an interpreter, many times what we're hearing is that some people, they go to the emergency room and the hospital doesn't get them an interpreter, or they go to a medical appointment and they don't get an interpreter. And while we try to put policies and practice in place that'll change that so that there's rules that they have to follow, we can't be everywhere. And so when a person who is deaf goes into an emergency room and they try to treat them without an interpreter, we try to teach people to have the skills on how to speak for themselves, how to get the family members to understand what avenues, what kind of things they can do to make it happen, to make the demand. I mean, a lot of people just are hesitant to speak up and say, I want an interpreter before you touch my body. But what we've been trying to do is to empower the individuals so that anywhere you go and any time you're somewhere, you have knowing that there is a law behind you, knowing that you have that right, and then speaking up and saying and speaking up for yourself and teaching family members how to help. But it's one of the things that, you know, we get questions all the time about how do you help in a certain area or with a certain disability. And like I said, we can't be everywhere, and unless we can empower the person with information, with encouragement, with giving them some fight in the belly, and getting them to speak up for themselves, that's about the only way you can really help people all the time. And so we don't just try to get that information and encouragement to the person, but to the family members, because oftentimes it's family members who are sitting there, and if you can't speak or if you're sick or ill, you're going to need that kind of an advocate with you. So we try to empower not just the people with disabilities, but their family and friends around them. And you absolutely have the right to an interpreter. And frankly, I would make the demand that you're not touching me until you get one. Or let your family members know that they must demand an interpreter. It just amazes me how people who are deaf are being treated. And sometimes we don't fray from the point that we're trying to reach of being in the community, but part of being in the community means making sure that you have the things that you need to be there. So while it may be not something that a coalition would be taking on, We still try to find other avenues to get training done or to get information out or to hold a, you know, hold an event where we can particularly talk about the issues for people who are deaf. Those are some of the things that we try to do. But like I said, it's more important to us, I think, that we empower the person and their family and friends to know what their rights are, so that and let them know that they have the right to stand up for them those, and they need to do it. I don't know if that helped answer your question. Not quite.
Yes, it does in a way, and I can only add this. I'm also thinking from the standpoint when we come at a point where besides our deafness, we are physically disabled, and can we go ahead and reside in our own community without having to be pushed into a nursing home or into another facility? But I just want to add one point. You are absolutely right. And I am running up against a brick wall in our area, being, quote, a rural area, where I have already met with the hospital officials, the administration, and I have instituted other people to come forth and advocate for themselves. The key point is advocating for yourself, but I'm also learning that many deaf people do not know their rights.
Exactly.
They do not know their rights. And to top that off, if a deaf person in the family has a hearing person, spouse, or whatever, hospitals, all resources tell them, you interpret for them.
Right.
You interpret for them. You know and I know that's illegal. My next remark even goes a step further. After meeting with hospital administration, and we tell them, you have to get interpreters. We've had the Office of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing in there speaking with them as well. They have said, you've got to get these interpreters. They are going forth, sent me a letter stating that they tried to get sign language interpreters to come to the area hospitals, and the interpreter refused to go that distance. So now the hospital is saying, we can't find sign language interpreters. I have an issue.
Well, my response would be bold. They can and they must get the interpreter there. One of the things that we're doing, one of those problems you see is administrative. There's a small group of us that are meeting with the State Hospital Association. And what we're gonna be doing is, we're being very nice right now and saying, what kind of ideas can you give us? But we're pulling together a focus group of hospitals so that at a state level, we can instill some practices that are gonna make sure that the hospitals have, you know, this is the policy, this is what you must do. But again, even though you have it in paper, even though you have a policy or practice and we get it changed, when you're in the rural areas, I live up in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, when you're in Pottsville Hospital, you're still gonna probably have to advocate for yourself, because even though a policy is in place that they're supposed to get you an interpreter, you're still gonna have to be advocating for yourself. So it's kind of, again, a combination of these things that's gonna make things really change.
When you're operating a coalition on one specific issue and you only discuss that one specific issue, what safeties have you put in place when you formed coalitions to prevent you from that narrow focus from causing you to cut your nose off to spite your face?
Brass knuckles.
No, he's asking the opposite question. What if you really should be going?
Well, I think one of the most important issues when you put in a coalition is coming together, is that initial decision of what is the breadth of your focus and what is the strategy, what are the strategies we're going to use to move towards that. And you hope that you make those right decisions in the beginning. Obviously, if down the road it appears you made a wrong decision, you need to revisit that with the coalition. Sometimes, interestingly, I have one coalition I've been part of, it's probably going on 20 years now, and
is probably the most effective coalition. I usually don't believe in coalitions going on for that long, but this particular one is extremely effective. And every few years, we sort of have to bring ourselves and say, remember why we got together, do you remember what our goals were, and sort of push back to those. We had three goals when we formed. We're not there yet, obviously. But sometimes you have to change those goals. I mean, if really, Linda and I were talking the other day, the day that the governor announced they were going to cut the hell out of Medicaid, everybody's priorities shifted in 24 hours, and suddenly everything you're working on became secondary to the fact that they were going to eliminate drug coverage, eliminate hospitalization, drug coverage, and everything else for everyone on Medicaid. So sometimes that does happen, and suddenly the world shifts before you know it.
Let's take a 5-minute break, just 5 minutes. I'll keep track. We'll have time for questions later. So don't wander too far. We're going to take a longer break in about an hour, but for now, we'll take 5 minutes.